Yes, she's an extremely distinguished journalist and writer, but also, I think, the hardest working journalist and writer in the business is the biographer of Enoch Powell, Vaughan Williams, and Thomas Carlyle. He's a leading columnist in the Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph. And while all of us were sitting staring at the ceiling during COVID, doing absolutely nothing, he went and edited 3,000-page volumes of the diaries of Chips Chan. And he wasn't satisfied with that. He has just finished his wonderful tetralogy, if that's the right word, of the history of Britain from 1838 to 1939. It's called Sing As We Go. We're delighted to have Professor Simon Heffer.
Harry, thank you for that charming introduction. I'll settle up with you later. It's a great honour for me not to be here, but to follow Timothy West, who I've admired for longer than I can remember. I once wrote a book about the political life of Edward VII, and then the second volume of my tetralogy had Edward VII with considerably more than a walk-on part. And whenever I was trying to envisage Edward VII, I envisaged Timothy playing him, which he did so brilliantly on television about 40 years ago. So I feel I owe him a great deal, and he's already appeared in two of my books. I've got 10 minutes to describe a book that is 960 pages long, which I work out as 96 pages a minute, which would give us all dizziness. So I think what I'll do is just, as we say in the trade, deal with the headlines. And the book covers 1919 to 1939. It is, as Harry said, the fourth in a series of four books from 1838 to 1939. I was only going to write one originally, and I was going to write a book on Queen Victoria, or Victorian England, and I'd already written nearly 1,000 pages when I'd only got to 1880, so it overspilt into another volume, and the rest is history, as they say. And this is the final volume, and one of the exciting things about doing historical research is that inevitably, whether you're a historian or a layperson, bring prejudices and ideas that you have absorbed from reading, from television, from your family about what the past was like. And then when you actually start looking at the facts, quite often the past turns out to be very much unlike what you've been told it was. This happened in three respects, really, with this book. The first was about the slump, which comes after the Wall Street crash in 1929. Doubtless many of you were there at the time and remember it. I almost do. And I was brought up on documentaries on television showing soup kitchens and absolute devastation and squalor in our economy in the 1930s. And I don't dispute that some of that happened. If you had the misfortune to be in a mining community, in a shipbuilding community such as Jarrow, or in one of the old heavy industries such as steel or cotton, you had a very hard time. But when unemployment peaked in this country in 1932 at 18%, it was at the same time in America peaking at 40%. Those of you who've read Steinbeck's novel The Grapes of Wrath or have seen the film of The Grapes of Wrath, which is a brilliant dramatization of that book, will have an idea of just how bad things were in America. You know, there really were people jumping out of windows in Wall Street in October 1929. And things were never so bad here. The 18% who were unemployed had a very hard time, as did their families. But the 82% who weren't unemployed got richer and richer. And the slump was turned round by 1934. Neville Chamberlain, in a famous speech, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, said, we've ceased having hard times and now we can have great expectations. And he was absolutely right. And while we think about these old heavy industries collapsing, and the cotton industry, by the way, had started to collapse long before the slump because we couldn't compete with imported cotton goods from India and China and Japan. When you think about that period, you forget that this is the era of radio. All around London, all around Birmingham, right through the West Midlands and the South East, there are endless new factories opening, making what they used to call the wireless. Anyone who knows specifically the old, they still do call the wireless. And the car industry becomes enormous. There are, by 1939, 9 million cars on the road in Britain, almost all of them made here. This is the golden age of our car industry. And there are factories, all the way through the Midlands, around London. Ford owns his factory in Dagenham in the 1920s. And where these new industries take off, there's fast new housing estates, both public housing and private housing. Wherever you live, whichever your nearest town is, you will have an outer circle of those wonderful 1930s semis with bow windows. Somebody might even live in one. And that's the surviving evidence of just how prosperous most of this country was in the 1930s. So that is the first thing that was news to me. I hadn't realized that I had been effectively propagandized about how bad capitalism was in the 1930s. The second thing is Neville Chamberlain. I'd grown up in that Churchillian school of history thinking that Neville Chamberlain actually had kowtowed to Hitler and had humiliated our country. During the lockdown that Harry so vividly described, when I'd finished dealing with Chips Chamberlain, I spent 6 weeks, as one does, reading online every letter that Neville Chamberlain wrote from 1922 until the war broke out. And he used to write every Saturday to his unmarried sisters. He had two unmarried sisters who lived in Hampshire. And one of them got a letter from him every Saturday and read it to the other. And he was absolutely frank and honest to his sisters, as you can be to people you've known since the nursery. And he makes it clear to them in 1934 that he thinks Hitler is a madman. He makes it clear to them when he gets back from Munich, having waved the piece of paper. He said, "I got carried away, I lost my head, I went too far." He was very susceptible to acts of vanity like that. But what I also learned from Chamberlain's private letters was that the day before he made the first of his three visits to Germany in September 1938, the chiefs of the three services went to see him, and each of them said to him in turn, "Prime Minister, I wish you all the best when you go to see Hitler, but whatever you do, don't declare war, because we haven't got an army, we've got an air force that's still being rebuilt, and the navy, which had been considerably rebuilt in the 1930s, is mostly on the China station because we're afraid the Japanese are going to invade Hong Kong and Singapore. So he said, if you declare war on Germany, we've had it. Don't do it." And he doesn't. He presents it in a very bad way to the British public. But actually, one of the reasons why we prevailed in the end was that we didn't go to war in the autumn of 1938, when I fear the Germans would have made very short work of us. So that was the second remarkable thing I learned. By the way, also about Chamberlain, he was a great Minister of Health in the 1920s. Being Minister of Health was effectively being Minister of Local Government. He laid the foundations of the National Health Service. He abolished the workhouse. Many people think the workhouse went out with Charles Dickens. It didn't. Charles Dickens died in 1870. The workhouses were still going until 1930 and were abolished by Chamberlain, because he thought they were inhumane, which of course they were. And he also created a national system for paying unemployment benefit. Because until 1927, if you were unemployed, your local authority paid for you. So if a local authority had thousands of unemployed men in its area, it went broke. Chamberlain realized this was unsustainable. If he hadn't nationalized the system and made it all a direct charge on central government, the country's administrative system would have collapsed in 1931 when unemployment was heading for 3 million. So he was an immensely distinguished, energetic, and quite brilliant minister. One of the best chancellors of the Exchequer in the history of our country. And I hope if my book does anything, if it makes people think again about Chamberlain and think better of him, then I've achieved something. The third and final thing that I worked out, and I'm not being entirely facetious, is what a very important part Gracie Fields played in saving this country from oblivion. When I told a fellow historian that I was writing this book about 3 or 4 years ago, he said, "You've got to watch a film called Sing As We Go." And I'd never heard of it. And I said, "Well, who's in that? And when did it come out?" He said, "Well, it's a 1934 film and it stars Gracie Fields and it's a musical." I said, "Right." So I went to Amazon, as one does, and I think I got 5 Gracie Fields films for £7. She's great value, let me assure you. And I watched this film, and to be quite frank with you, it's awful. But, there was always a but. I rang my friend up and said, okay, I watched this film. I'll tell you the story if you haven't seen it, spoiler alert. Our Gracie is working in a cotton mill, somewhere like Rochdale, and she loses her job. The mill has to close down because it can't compete with the aforementioned cheap cotton imports from around the world. And the toff who runs the mill goes to see her and says, I'm terribly sorry, Gracie, but I'm afraid the mill's going to have to close down and you're all losing your jobs. So very bad luck, and it's quite a nice scenario, and off you go. So Gracie does what everybody does if they lose their job in a cotton mill. She goes to Blackpool and gets a job at the end of the pier ship. And she has various scrapes and japes for 80 minutes. And then the toff turns up again at the end. He says, oh, Gracie, I'm so glad I found you. We've managed to discover this miracle process. And what happens is, we can make cotton goods so much more cheaply than we used to. So we're going to reopen the factory. We want you to be head of personnel. I sort of know what you're going to be, HR, for those of you who need translation. You're going to be head of personnel, and you're going to lead the girls back to work, which she does in what vulgarians describe as an iconic scene at the end of the film. She marches under a Union Jack in front of all the girls, and they're going back to make lots of cotton goods to sell to the world. And this film has two interesting aspects. It's a fantastic piece of documentary footage. It's all filmed in the summer of 1934 with lots of location shots on the front of Blackpool. So if you want an idea of what Waits Week looked like when they all went to Blackpool for their holidays, this is the most brilliant piece of cinematography that shows it. And it's worth watching for that reason alone. But also, it is a really classic piece of work by J.P. Priestley. He wrote it. Now, Priestley at the time was the most famous popular novelist in Britain. He'd taken over from Arnold Bennett, who died in 1931, in that role. And he wrote this as a straightforward piece of national government propaganda. It's a film about, again, what Bennett called the great cause of cheering us all up. And I looked at the viewing figures. One example, within, I think, a 2-mile radius of Bolton Town Hall in 1934, there were 27 cinemas. And at one stage, this film was on at all of them. And it works out that virtually everybody in the area went to see it half a dozen times while it was showing. And I found a letter written by an unemployed docker to a film magazine. And he said to the film magazine, I love the cinema. He said, I'm just about afford to go once a week after my dole. And this really makes my life different. It really cheers me up. It really keeps me going. And going to see a propaganda film like Sing As We Go, because that's what it is, it's about saying to the very hard done by working class in this country, keep your chin up, it's all going to be all right. And Gracie Fields, I think, did her bit in saving this country from revolution. Because you think about all the way around Europe, you've got Hitler turning ugly in Germany, you've got a civil war in Spain, you've got civil war nearly breaking out in France in 1936, you've got Austria all over the place, you've got Mussolini in Italy. Things are even a bit rough in Belgium, but in Britain we don't have a revolution. Partly because Mr. Chamberlain has founded a basic welfare state and people are not starving, but also because our people are constantly cheered up, and it's a frame of mind, it's a sense of humour that carries over into the Second World War and also helps us prevail when 1939 and all its trials come. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure to speak to you. I hope you might think that the book is worth reading and is interesting. You can always write and ask me for your money back if you do buy it, if you don't like it. Yes, and this lady's going to do that. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.